Welcome, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters, and oh my, Paradigm Shifter Russell Friedman is going to help you and I shift paradigms that we go through in our lives where we have losses of all kinds, whether it's death of someone or death of a pet or a loss of a dream. Oh my goodness, there are so many losses that as our life goes on, we go through huge, huge reactions, don't we? So welcome to the show, Russell Friedman, who had a lot to do with starting the Grief Recovery Institute here in LA. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm just delighted to be with you.
I'm delighted to have you here. And I think the people at home are as well. Now, how did you, Russell Friedman, get involved in starting a Grief Recovery Institute?
Totally by accident, which is probably the best way for a new life and a new career to happen. I was on the heels of my second divorce and a bankruptcy for $500,000. This is like 29 years ago. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine dragged me, kind of kicking and screaming, to an event at a hotel. There was a couple hundred people, and the speaker at that event was a fellow named John W. James, who I had never heard of before, and is now my partner and my friend and co-author. And he was lecturing on grief recovery. It was kind of a one-day overview workshop. And on that day, I had some very exciting awareness. One was that grief is not limited to death, that my divorce and my bankruptcy were massive grieving experiences, but I wouldn't have known that before. Like most people, I thought grief was about death. So mm-hmm. It was like an eye-opening thing, along with the possibility of recovery, of not having to feel like and act like and drag the sense of being a victim around with me forever. And in dragging the victim around, kind of be still being a victim, so that I couldn't trust that I could be in any kind of relationships, romantic, business, or anything, as long as I was dragging that. But I didn't know that. So there's a lot of light bulbs went off that day.
Thank you, Russell. But also, tell us a few more of the symptoms of grief, because can they not be also very physical?
Well, yes, some of them are, very classically. The number one first response, especially to a death, is a sense of numbness, which is either very physical or the absence of physical feeling. And basically, that is the body, the mind, the whole platform shutting down in a way of protecting us in order to survive. If you felt every ounce of what you might feel if someone meaningful to you died, it could literally kill you. So the body does a thing I call emotional Novocaine, or it's like it shuts off a circuit breaker.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. It is the most common report, a sense of numbness. But the more physiological thing that's universal for every griever, regardless whether it's a death or a divorce or any other loss they're grieving, is an inability to concentrate or focus. And the humor is, you're in one room, you go to the kitchen to get something. When you get there, you go, huh? What am I doing here? And everybody listening to us will have had that experience, whether it was a major loss that affected them or a less major one. And the inability to concentrate or focus can last indefinitely, months, even
mine lasted 10 years.
That's a long gap. And during that time, you can have accidents and other things, make all kinds of mistakes and judgment because you're not fully present.
Mm-hmm. And people don't get very patient, do they?
No. In fact, the closer they are to you and the more they know you, the less patient they eventually get, because they have been schooled incorrectly to believe that time is going to heal you. Mm-hmm. And when you don't get better, they're telling you, well, you should be over it by now. And get on with it. Yeah. And it makes you feel worse, not better.
Yeah. And actually, you're saying physiologically, it's a real issue, isn't it?
It's a real issue if you don't apply any construct of recovery or how do I complete and get better. It's like if you get a cut and don't clean it, it can get infected. It gets worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. Well, grief, if you don't attend to it, gets worse, not better. Time doesn't heal. Time compounds loss and makes it worse.
Mm-hmm. Unless you really look at it. Now, let's talk about your meeting with John James. I interrupted that.
But, no, that's fine. So I met John on that day, and I got his card. And the next day, I was sitting in my little apartment all by myself, and I had the prior week my car had been repossessed with the bankruptcy. I mean, just like that Repo Man movie. I mean, it was scary, too. A real character showed up at my door asking for my keys.
Oh, wow.
The next day after being at this event with John, I saw his card. So on an impulse that I cannot explain to you, I called him and I said, "Hi, my name is Russell. I was at that thing by the airport yesterday and I just called to say thank you." And he said, "You're welcome." And then there was a pause. And then a voice came out of my mouth and it said, "And I want to volunteer to work for you." And wonderful. I looked around my apartment. I was the only one there. I thought, who said that? And I could hear John at the other end going, "Who is this fool? I mean, I've been an axe murderer. He didn't know who I was." So he said, "Well, can you come up here tomorrow and we'll talk?" And as it was, the office was only a few blocks from my apartment. So I went up there. And when John tells the story, he said, "Russell came up one day 29 years ago, and I haven't been able to get rid of him yet. So we're friends, we're partners, we write books together." And that is the absolute true story. And for me, Veronica, it is a story, a heartwarming story for me of one unique time in my life that I actually followed an intuitive impulse, and it led me to what I do and how I have lived the last 29 years. And one more little note. When I arrived at the Institute 29 years ago, I would have traded my existence with anyone on planet Earth. That's how miserable I was. And today, I wouldn't trade with anybody.
Wow.
And that's a miracle. I'm not saying I'm perfect, but I just wouldn't trade.
Alive.
I got comfortable in my skin.
Wow. Now tell me this, if people have grief and they're not comfortable in their skin, it gets a lot worse, doesn't it?
Yes, because time, as we said, only compounds a wound. It doesn't make it better. And because in a crisis, we go back to old behavior, old belief, you know, which really conforms to your show title and the idea, I think, of your show, The Paradigm Shifters, to move off of position to a better position. But in order to do that, you have to sometimes jump the tracks and go to something different than some linear idea of where you were going. And I think grief recovery in the scope of the world is that. Most people try to deal with grief in ways that don't make sense, but they're ways that are based on what they know. So if you learned all kinds of wrong stuff in childhood about dealing with grief, then when there's grief, that's what you will apply, because our line is, in a crisis, we go back to old behavior or old beliefs. Well, you can't shift your paradigm by using the same old beliefs you've been using. You're just going to get the same result.
Well, and also, if somebody's had a lot of abuse or something on the more extreme level, what happens to them in a state of grief? It could be pretty, not just compounding, but it could make them really crazy, right?
Well, again, yes, and yes with an apostrophe, no. And if you don't have the tools or actions to help you grieve and complete your relationship to the loss, now I'm gonna kind of enumerate what the losses are when you're abused. And it may not be universal, but it's close. Loss of safety, loss of trust, loss of control of my body. Those are three of the biggest. Whether the abuse is physical, sexual, emotional, or all three, or one or two or three, that's what the losses are. And those losses are in relationship to people or person or peoples who have been the perpetrators or the ones who didn't stand up for us or help us or notice us or get us out of harm's way. So the actual process of completing the unfinished emotional business caused by abuse isn't radically different than for dealing with the death, a divorce, or any other loss. It is the same set of actions applied in very much the same way.
So you lose yourself.
Say it again.
You lose yourself.
Well, you do lose yourself, but you can't find yourself. You have to find yourself in relationship to others. We don't encourage or allow people to try to to do themselves. What we do is we use our relationships with other people. In other words, I am the common denominator in all my relationships. And so when I work on my relationship with my mom, I discover certain things with my dad, certain things with my brothers, my wife, my ex-wives, my current spouse. As I do the work, what's emerging is a truer and more accurate picture of me. But if I look at me and try to tell you about me, it won't be accurate because I can't see me clearly. Now, if you and I were spouses and we're out to dinner with another couple and I'm saying, Lyle, well, I'm like this and I'm that and I'm that. And you're going to look at me at some point and go, excuse me, on what planet do you think you're like that? Because your perception of me on certain things will be much more accurate than my own and vice versa. So it's kind of like that old thing when, do you remember the first time you ever heard your own voice on a tape recorder?
Yes.
It doesn't sound like you. Well, when you talk about yourself, it is through the filter of your life experience, which is automatically, no matter how honest you are, it's automatically tainted or torqued by your life experience. It's like you looking at you about you can't be accurate, okay? But as you look at yourself in relationship to mom, then in relationship to dad and other major people who affected your life, what emerges is a much more accurate picture than if you just sit and talk about yourself. And that, Veronica, is one of the major differences between grief recovery and therapy. And it's also where they can come together if a good therapist who's also a grief recovery specialist can use the tools of grief recovery to help people get more accurate. I don't want to say they were dishonest about themselves, but it's hard to be accurate about yourself because you can't see yourself clearly. When you do the grief recovery work, it gives you more clarity about yourself, and then the changes and values of therapy work even better.
Well, when you met John James, and that makes a lot of sense to me, but when you met him, you two put your heads together and created this center. What did you know about grief therapy at the time, or was he studying it? Wasn't that around the time that Kubler-Ross was doing her thing?
No, actually, it's later. This would be in the late John. I met John in the early 80s, mid-80s. And actually, John knew Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She was in the 60s. Her book came out, her famous book came out in 67, I think. John used to be on platforms with her. John actually started grief recovery 10 years before I got there. So he's really the original founder, the original creator. When he and I joined, when I got there in 1986, or 85, whatever year, I can't remember now, a long time ago, almost 30 years ago, he had already established this. What happened was he and I refined it. His original book, The Grief Recovery Handbook, was focused almost exclusively on death, and it had a co-author named Frank Cherry. We got Frank to step away from the book, and we got HarperCollins to do a new edition, the revised edition, which addressed directly divorce. So divorce was on the subtitle, The Action Program for Moving Beyond Death, Divorce, and Other Losses. And it expanded. And since then, we've expanded it to include loss of health, loss of career, and loss of faith. So we now approach all issues, and we're about to address the issue of trauma and PTSD, things we've stayed away from for a while, but we are going to address them in the next edition. So John was there and had established a powerful, Veronica, a powerful foundation, and then together he and I have built on it, refined it, made the process, the method work better, made it more accessible to more people. We've come up with a piece of language to redefine forgiveness for people who have been so trapped by not, especially those people abused, who couldn't forgive, and the absence of forgiving was killing them. They were being hurt more by their memories of what was done to them than by the actual abuse. I know that's hard to say, but that's their report. So we have found ways to help them out of the trap of their own memory box, which sometimes is a worse, I don't want to say it's worse, it's unfair, because all abuse is horrible. But if you trap yourself when the perpetrator isn't doing anything to you anymore, just by your memory, that's a real problem. So we're very proud of helping people out of a trap that can be beyond life-limiting.
Mm-hmm. And So why don't we take an example here? Who comes to you? Well, first of all, I wanted to say, didn't John have a terrible loss, which is what spurred him into this subject?
Absolutely. Whereas, as you know, I came in on the heels of a second divorce and bankruptcy. What promoted John into this field was the death of a three-day-old baby son in 1977. Oh. And in the hallway of the hospital, less than 20 minutes after the baby died, a well-meaning, loving friend, a doctor, said to John, quote, "Don't feel bad. You should feel grateful. You and Marcy are young. You can have other children." And here's the miracle, Veronica. John is a Vietnam combat veteran. That's the doctor. Doctor who said that is still alive is a miracle, because if John had been less zombified, less numb from
his own grief,
of the death, he would have strangled the guy for saying, "Oh, don't feel bad. Just go home and make another baby. Don't, you're younger, you can have other children."
If he had been in Vietnam, didn't he also have a numbness from all of that?
Well, yeah, except numbness wears off usually very quickly, no matter what the loss. He certainly had ongoing scarring from it, he probably would say. Numbness is a very short-term thing. Couple of days, maybe, usually not even that long, a day or two of numbness after a death. The Vietnam impact, different impact, and that kind of thing. And John came back right at the time where he was embarrassed to say he'd been over there, because remember, when the vets came back, they were called baby killers because of My Lai. So he went through a whole period of adjustment, and as did many of the vets. And I don't know if you realize, more veterans of Vietnam War have died due to suicide than the total amount who died in the war.
Wow.
And in major part because of how they were treated and not treated on their return to this country. So that's a kind of societal disaster, something that this country can't be proud of, because we didn't do right by that.
He must have found something about grief recovery for himself, did he?
Well, yeah, it's an interesting story, and I love telling it. John is a certain kind of guy. He's very orderly. He's very precise, and he likes things in certain ways. And in the aftermath of the death of the baby, he found he could not move forward. He had experienced a death when he was 25. His 20-year-old brother laid down to take a nap and died, and somehow John survived that. His dad died of alcoholism at a relatively young age, and somehow John survived that. But when the baby died, John could not accommodate it. He couldn't adapt. He couldn't move forward in life.
But this is an accumulative thing then, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. It's a little different. Yes is a partial answer, but it's not entirely that, because as you hear this unfold, so John said, "I can't live another 40 or 50 years feeling the way I'm feeling." So he went on a mission to discover what was different about the death of the baby as compared to the death of his brother and the death of his father. And one day, quite by accident, sitting forlornly at his kitchen table, after the inevitable divorce that often accompanies a child loss marriage, he's sitting there with a piece of paper and he writes down a couple of words. And the words are hopes, dreams, expectations. His brain had tumbled that the one major difference in the death of the baby from those other two deaths I mentioned is that all he had with the baby was a relationship to the hopes, dreams, and expectations he had had about what that baby would be and how he would be a better father to his son than his father had been to him. You know, very typical kind of thing. And that those three words, hopes, dreams, and expectations, were the key that opened the door to John to create the grief recovery method. He then realized that there were a whole host of things that he wished had happened differently, better or more, along with the hopes, dreams, and expectations. And with that, he stumbled on this method that helps people discover and complete what's unfinished. Hmm. And in helping himself be able and willing to want to participate in life again, even in spite of the death of the baby, he realized he was able to help other couples who had a baby die. And friends started bringing other couples to him. And then quite as a fluke because he was in the construction business. He wasn't a caregiver. He's not a therapist or social worker. Quite by fluke, he realized, and some other people realized, that the process would help you if you're dealing with death of a parent, not death, just death of a child or death of a spouse. And then when I came along, we realized, oh my gosh, this works on divorce and bankruptcy. And so we have expanded the application of the method to all losses, and it's immaculate. And here's the best way to explain it. You, if you know anything, there's this program called AA, and they're alcoholics. And you could be a drunk whose drink was gin, and you learn to get sober, and then you can sponsor. Now, you could then sponsor a woman whose drink was vodka. It doesn't have to be gin for gin or gin for vodka. It's you. When you learn the process of being sober, it applies to all beverages.
Right.
So when you learn the method of grief recovery, it applies to all losses. It is not limited to a type of loss. Mm-hmm. It's a universal application. When done effectively, works on every loss.
Wow, it's really exciting. But doesn't it have a lot to do with the loss of, well, you talked about expectancies, but the loss of one's identity and how a person sees himself or herself in those contexts?
To a certain degree, and some degrees more than other. When you are married, a long-term marriage, and your long-term spouse dies, you have an identity within that. But that isn't the typical complaint. Loss of identity will be more like stuff when you're abused, and the loss of childhood, the loss of sense of value. In long-term relationships with children and spouses, we don't usually apply the idea of loss of identity. It does come in something. Loss of identity is a subtopic.
Okay.
It's a subtopic within your relationship with someone or something else.
Wow. Okay. So now somebody comes to your grief center, and you've had it for 29 years now. You probably run the gamut of who comes. What
yes.
kind of people come, young or old? Do you ever work with really old people or?
The range is infinite. Because we do create some limitations, I think the youngest I've ever had in a seminar or workshop is 15. Well, okay. We don't do many people under 18, just for kind of legal reasons. But people well up into their 90s, so the range is from here to there, and from every country on this globe, from places you've never heard of, whose original language and cultures you don't even know, me neither, and you discover things. And what was really fascinating, Veronica, and I've stopped being stunned by it, we have people literally from every corner of the globe, from every background, every religion, every cultural aspect. And when we outline the six major myths that negatively impact grieving people.
What are the six major myths?
The first myth is the myth, don't feel bad, which we all get as kids. Don't feel bad, here, have a cookie, you'll feel better.
Right.
Well, why someone would tell you not to feel bad when you do feel bad makes no sense. Can you imagine if you called me, Veronica, and you said, hey, Russell, it's your pal, Veronica. I say, how are you doing? You say, I'm great. I'm having a great day. Everything's going well. Things are really good at the show. And would I say, don't feel good? I mean, what?
No,
but the minute, if you call and say, my favorite aunt died, your friend's going to say, oh, don't feel bad. She's in a better place, which may or may not be true for the person who died. But we know the griever's not in a better place. So the idea of not feeling bad when it is normal and natural to feel bad or sad when something bad or sad happens. When we take people's normal feelings away, we're hurting them, not helping them. And yet the number one thing said to all grievers, don't feel bad. Don't feel bad. God won't give you more than you can handle, which is usually said to people who are drowning in their sorrow. Don't feel bad is the either stated or implied message in almost all incorrect grief language. Then there's a replace the loss. You know, when you're a little kid and your dog dies, don't feel bad. On Saturday, we'll get you a new dog. And the truth is, you can't replace a relationship. And our relationships with our pets are as unique and individual as our relationships with people. And then that one gets translated. So when you were a teenage girl, or I was a teenage boy, had your first romantic breakup and your heart was crushed, which it really is when you're 14, 15, 16, mm-hmm. and your mother or father says, oh, honey, don't feel bad. There are plenty of fish in the sea.
Yeah, you're young yet.
Yeah? Yeah. Which is the first time you knew you had been dating a fish. Yeah, so you're young yet. And if you fall off a horse, you're going to get right back on. All these animal images. Anyhow, the issue is you do feel bad. And here's someone you're supposed to trust, your mom or dad or someone else, right, telling you not to feel the way you feel. And again, think about it. If you felt good, would they tell you, don't feel good? So it basically negates half of your feeling potential by telling you you shouldn't feel sad when you're sad. You can only feel happy when you're happy. It's like, where do the other feelings go? Then we have the classic grieve alone, laugh and the whole world laughs with you, cry and you cry alone, which is not true. It's a learned, incorrect lie. Because the truth is, I will tell you your truth, and if you want to argue with me, fine. If you get some really nice, wonderful, good news, what's the first thing you want to do, Veronica?
Share it.
Yes. And if you get some sad news, what's the first thing you want to do, Veronica?
Probably share it.
Yes, that's the correct answer, even though you had to say probably. But that is the correct answer. When we get information that affects us emotionally, whether it's positive or negative, the natural impulse is, oh, I need to tell someone. I need to share this. And yet we've been told, hey, if you're going to cry, go to your room. Knock off that crying or I'll give you your
business. Isn't that interesting? Oh, my goodness.
It's fascinating. And then the biggest myth of all, the worst of all, although they're all the worst, it's just time heals all wounds. And I can tell you this with no fear of contradiction, that time can't heal an emotional wound any more than time could fix a flat tire. Mm-hmm. Time is passive. Time goes by, but it doesn't do anything. It is what you do within time that creates change or recovery or healing or whatever language you want to put on it. But if you don't do anything, nothing happens.
Right.
Okay. Imagine you wanted to learn how to play the piano.
Right.
So you got a piano and you sat in front of the piano every day, but you never listened to the cover. You never touched it. You sat there an hour every day for 30 years.
Right.
30 years later, can you play the piano? No, ma'am. You didn't touch it. You can't play it. I mean, you didn't practice. So, but grief is the same way. I want to tell you and your listeners something sadly fascinating. I have personally talked to over 100,000 grieving people.
That's a lot.
And I'm not talking on your radio show or on TV. I've been on CNN many times. I've talked to millions, but personally, on the phone or in person, I've talked to 100,000 people. That's 29 years, 20 people a day, 5 days a week. You do the math, a big number. And a huge percentage of them, Veronica, were widows or widowers.
Okay.
Who called here to our 800 number a year or two after their spouse of 30, 40, 50 years had died. Okay. And you imagine what it takes to propel you to call a stranger on an 800 number.
Right.
How bad must you be feeling to do that? How your world will have shrunk.
Right.
And after a certain point in the conversation, I would say to them, you know, I guess you realize they lied to us. And they go, huh? And I go, time hasn't healed your broken heart, has it? And do you want to know something? 95% of them said, yeah, and it feels like it's getting worse. Well, it has to be getting worse.
Because
if you're calling me a year or two later, it ain't getting better. You ain't calling some 800 grief recovery and saying, hey, whoever you are, I feel great. I don't need you. Bye. I ain't got that call yet. I'm waiting for that one. It's not going to happen, is it?
No. So what you're saying is that the grief itself piles up if you don't look at it, if you don't experience
it. Don't do anything about it. Grief doesn't fix itself any more than a flat tire does. It's a perfect metaphor. You must take action. The problem is you don't know what action to take. And if you were socialized, maybe you weren't supposed to feel bad in the first place, okay, and that time heals. So watch this next one. You and everyone else listening was taught at some level in dealing with grief that you have to be strong or be strong for others. And when you're being strong, when it's not what you're really feeling, what you're doing is lying. You're
right.
Covering up the truth. And when you hide the truth, it gets buried inside your little belly or your little heart, and only where it can explode sometime when you're not expecting it. It's the dumbest thing. And here's a choice we give people. You can be strong or you can be human. Pick one.
How about a strong human? But let me ask you this,
being
Russell.
Being strong is being honest, I think. Go ahead.
Okay, having your divorce and your bankruptcy and meeting John and starting all this, how long did it take you to enter those realms and unhook yourself?
That's the most fascinating part about grief recovery. It actually is a very fast action process. It can happen almost as fast as you can imagine. I was talking to someone earlier today, and I had a chance to revisit one of the most thrilling things I've ever been associated with. Years ago, and I used to do 3-day personal workshops, not trainings, but just people come for 3 days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 8-hour days, and do all the work. I had a woman come to this personal workshop whose husband of 42 years had died 3 days before this event. The event was started on Friday. Her husband died on Tuesday.
Okay.
Now, most people go, oh my gosh, how could she be there? And I said, well, probably it's the best place in the world, because I'm going to tell you a little secret. In the first few days, weeks, even months after the death of your spouse or the death of your son or daughter or parent or whatever, the only thing on your heart, your mind, your soul, and your body is your relationship with them and what happened to them, the fact that they're not here. You will never have more accurate memories of your relationship with that person than in the first few days, because memory fades and alters over time, and grievers tend to create larger-than-life memory pictures in which they either enshrine or bedevil the person. But in those first 3 days, first week, all it is blooming truth with tears attached, with anger attached, with sweetness attached, with whatever feelings attached, because there's nothing. Look, at when your spouse dies, you are not interested in the weather. You're not interested in the sales at the grocery store or the department store. You're not interested in sports. You're not interested in anything other than your broken heart. It dominates. It is actually easier for me to help someone access everything in the immediate aftermath than it is months later or years later. Although, blessedly, we can help people decades later. But frankly, if I get a choice, I want you here the day it happens, because you won't have anything else in the world you want to talk about than that. And all of it is about your relationship with the person who died, the good, the bad, and sometimes the ugly that's mixed in.
Mm-hmm. And also, you don't feel well. I remember that.
You do not
feel well. Your stomach feels like you've been punched, and you're...
Yep. Yep.
Brain is woozy and you can't read a book, and it's incredible.
Yeah, now watch this. Grieving people need and want an opportunity to talk about what happened and their relationship with the person it happened to. Therefore, if you step into my environment within days after the death of your spouse or whoever, it actually, you stop feeling bad, because the very thing you most need and want to do is exposed and allowed to happen. One of the reasons you don't feel good is that most people won't let you talk openly about how you feel correctly. And we guide it so that what we guide people to is their relationship with the person who died rather than their relationship to their pain. Relationship to the pain sometimes traps people away from recovery.
Oh, really?
Yes. It's a fascinating, it almost seems like a puzzle.
When you say relationship to the pain, you mean your stomach ache or your heartache?
I'm actually talking about something that you were talking about earlier. Within a very short order, Veronica, people start developing a relationship or identity with their pain. That might include the stomach. I'm not really so much addressing the physical.
Okay.
But I'll tell you, if someone can approach the griever correctly or create a safe environment, those ailment-type things tend to disappear. Because if I can help someone, gosh, tell me a little bit about your relationship with your husband. All of a sudden, your stomach becomes irrelevant, and you start, oh my gosh, well, when did you first meet? And when that story starts, your body's going to be fully engaged in telling that and having a willing audience, and then I can guide you and say, oh gosh, how exciting that! Oh my gosh, how frustrating! And we find the feelings that are attached to that relationship, and that's what it's all about. Finally, someone knows the right way to help you address what you are really looking to do, rather than just lamenting the pain. Mm. That is not to dismiss or minimize or diminish the pain. It's real. I'm not saying that.
Well, that's really interesting. So you were talking about the myths. Did we get to myth 4?
No, we got through 5, and the one we didn't get to yet is the myth, and everyone's heard this. What you got to do is keep busy. Well, we've seen people nearly work themselves into an early grave trying to stay busy after a death or a divorce. And keeping busy is really a variation on time heals all wounds, with the idea if I can just stay busy today, then another day goes by and I get to feel better because time's going to heal it.
Right.
The truth is it gets worse within time and gets buried out of sight, where it's actually much more dangerous out of sight than it is in sight.
That's really good to know, isn't it? You know, it occurs to me as we're talking that I know animals also grieve terribly, like elephants grieve for one another. Mongoose grieves deeply for its mate and will not mate again, you know.
Right, right.
So talk about identity. Do you know anything about animals and grief?
Well, I have a limited range. Our newest book is The Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss, but that book is actually about human grief over the death of our pets rather than because I'm not an animal behaviorist or a studier of that. But my life is built around my dog Baxter and I have are agility champions. We have competed all around the country in agility. And almost everybody I know owns several dogs, and they're in this dog world. But I don't have enough knowledge to comment. I do believe that mammals grieve. I think that what most dogs and cats do is, excuse me, is different than what we people do, because how their relationships with us and with each other from a grief point of view are different because their minds are different. And it's very hard to talk about it clearly because there's an automatic inclination to anthropomorphize and put it through the filter of how I perceive grief,
right,
or feelings. And it's a little hard to separate. But I agree with anyone. If anyone says animals grieve, I agree. Now, I would generally say it a little different than the mongoose or mongooses, however you say that, and the elephants. With the dogs and cats, I think they grieve like we do for the end of familiar. Animals are very routine oriented, and so if one of the pack or one of their tribe is missing, they notice that, and that affects them. Beyond that, I'm not prepared to say, although I would lean towards believing they do have a dimension of grief that's, at least at some level, Veronica, parallel with ours. It's different but parallel, I think.
Mm-hmm. I've heard stories lately about some dogs who never did recover from the loss of their fellow pet, you know, their fellow dog kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I thought that was remarkable because I've been talking to you and I think grief is a very interesting subject. So,
yeah, I agree. I think dogs are individual and unique, as are people. And some dogs are devastated forever by the end of a mate. So, you know, not even a romantic mate, but, you know, they're one they live with. On the other hand, some dogs adapt fairly well, and when a new dog comes in, they seem to go on with their life, with their new relationship. So I suspect underneath there's a uniqueness to each dog, as there is with each person. And then if I were in that field, I would approach it that way. So I wouldn't say that, Veronica, that you are like any other griever who ever lived. But I'm
exactly
not going to say no one is. I'm always have to help you find what your truth is, not my opinion, not someone's opinion, never compare you to anyone else. And I would give the same logical courtesy to a dog or cat, even though I can't talk to them like this, that they have unique grief based on who they are and their unique relationship with the other being or other animal, whatever it was.
Oh, that makes incredible sense. All right, let's go back to the people and who comes to you? Do you have some interesting cases of people that were the whole thing about PTSD is a very big deal, and it's a really massive kind of grief, is it not?
Well, unfortunately, I think it has been given that title, and that is what's caused more problems than solutions. The minute anyone labels one loss as bigger or more affecting than others, they've done a disservice to grievers. Because, as we were just talking, everyone's reaction is unique. When my mother died suddenly in 1993, the day before Thanksgiving, and I happened to have my sisters are identical twins. They're 2.5 years younger than I am. Identical twins, one egg split in two. That's different than fraternal twins. And when our mom died, they had totally different reactions. And yet they were raised at the same home, the same time. They were dressed identically. You wouldn't have been able to tell them apart when they were 5, 6, 7. And yet the emotional differences between my sisters in reaction to the death of our mutual mother, their mutual mother. You wouldn't even know they were from the same family, judging if you watched it that way. So it always reminds me that I must never categorize grievers in that way. And I must help each griever find a unique truth for them about their unique relationship with someone who died. Now, when it comes to some special circumstances, there are some things that you and I don't know you that well, Veronica, but there are some things that would just make you go, oh my gosh, I can't even stand to hear that. People have witnessed things, you know, things I won't even say out loud on the air. They've witnessed tragedies in car accidents or other kind of violent things that it's almost impossible to imagine. And some people are so devastated and traumatized that for the rest of their life, they can't get the image out of their mind's eye.
Yeah, other that's people, very interesting stuff, isn't it?
It is. And at the same time, other people witnessing the same thing at the same time will go, yeah, I remember. Yeah, it was kind of awkward. And they are not ruined by it. Now, how do you explain you and I standing and watching thing and you having a lifelong affliction from it, me going, yeah, it was pretty awkward, but I don't think about it at all. Now, is that normal? Yes. It just kind of defines the difference between people, the range of perception. If you have a more scientific mind, if you're like a doctor or someone who likes, you know, like if you enjoy doing the, what did you call the autopsies in science class when you were in college biology, other people you could look at taking a crawfish apart. I mean, again, I don't mean to be graphic here on the air. Some people can do that. Some can't. I am very squeamish, so even the mention of those things, other people go, oh, I can talk about it all day. The image, no, I can look at it. So,
well, what do you think that is? That's our basic nature, isn't that?
It's our nature to be different.
The uniqueness. From one to the
other. Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Our basic nature is to be different from each other in variations that come with under a general heading of normal. So one, you could be at one end of the scale and I could be at the other, and we could both be normal. Mm-hmm. It's just that you might be able to look at and talk about things that I find gruesome and graphic. Oh, I can't, for example, I can't watch horror movies. Even the music makes me crazy. When I hear scary music, I'm ready to go under the table. My wife is saying, you're such a big sissy.
Good.
Or I'm very suggestible. On the other hand, I can talk to people. I've talked to grievers who've told me stuff that would literally curl your hair, Veronica. Mm-hmm. And yet I can do that in the context of helping someone. I can set aside that squeamishness and listen to them and not be revolted by the thing they're telling me. So I have developed a unique ability to do that in spite of my own kind of, you know, I got to tell you, I was on live air on Channel 5 here in Los Angeles, which is one of the major independent stations, the morning of 9/11. They called me up, I put on my suit and tie, and I spent 6 hours at the desk at the, you know, where all the news anchor desk. And in front of me that day were about 40 banks of monitors, and I saw the image of the towers coming down, the planes going into, and the people jumping out of the building.
1,000 times, yeah.
10,000. To this day, I mean, I can watch a little now, but for years I wouldn't watch. I couldn't. Was I traumatized? I don't know. I just didn't want to watch it. It did it affect me? You bet your life. I don't believe I have PTSD from observing that, but I sure had a hard time ever wanting to see those images again. Other people could watch that and go, yeah, I saw it. Okay, no big deal. So is anybody right or wrong? No. Are we all unique? And that's, I think, where we land. And I think it's where we need to land, Veronica. And anything that we do grief recovery-wise, it's helping people find their individual and unique response to someone living or dead, someone important to them, someone who affected their life, so they can move forward. And that means having them find their truth, not my opinion of their truth.
I like that a lot. I like how you're putting that.
Thanks.
When we're talking, just jumping around a little bit, PTSD, would you say is like grief in the sense that it affects, it's a stress trauma reaction which affects some people and other people don't have to have it? Is that?
You know, it's a fascinating question. And I must tell you, I suppose it'd be a good self-disclosure, I am working on a major chapter for a new book on that topic. And I've been obviously doing a lot of research. For, you know, I'm sure you know this, that PTSD is a modern piece of language that has evolved from many other pieces of language that preceded. The one you might be aware of, although you're, you know, way too young to have known it directly, actually comes from World War One, when it was called shell shock.
I remember hearing
about it. You remember hearing about it, just like me. What it was is that, and you have to imagine this, every day of your life, you're in a war zone, you're in a trench, you're in Germany or wherever you are.
Right.
And every time you hear a whistling sound, it's a bomb. And if you hear it, I can't remember what the guideline is. If you hear it, you're dead. If you don't hear it, you're dead. I can't remember which one.
Yeah, some sections or something.
Imagine how your shoulder just clenching every time you hear a plane go overhead. And imagine being submitted to that every day, every night, 24 hours a day for months and months and months.
That'd be a lot.
That'd be a lot. And I don't care who you are. And I had relatives who came home with impact from World War II, even, of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Now, not everybody afflicted the same way. But what happened has happened is that where for many years it was almost always war-related, and it made a certain sense. The constant bombardment where you could die any second, Veronica, any second, any breath second. Could be your last.
Yep.
It got morphed so that nowadays the phrase PTSD is used for almost everything, not to minimize things, but it is applied in places that don't come under the heading of a constant barrage or bombardment over and over and over. It is now applied to singular events. And it's interesting because I can't argue that either. If we introduce or just separate out the word trauma or traumatic, rape is probably one of the most traumatic things that anyone ever experiences. And of course, a loss of safety, loss of trust, loss of control of my body, and so on. But it's a singular event. And hopefully, you know, but there are people who have been raped more times than once. But the point is, it isn't a constant bombardment like imagining the shells falling.
Like if you're in shells, yeah, I understand.
Exactly.
That, yeah.
And yet, and here's the problem. The language is now applied universally to everything, whereas it used to apply more to something that you could understand in a repeated threat on your life, real threat on your life 24/7. So now it forces me and you and everyone else to learn a definition that's much more vague. For grief recovery purposes, if someone tells me they have PTSD or they tell me they were abused, if they tell me they were abused, for example, and as a result have PTSD, what I'm going to say is, okay, you were abused by your grandfather? Okay, so I imagine you experienced a loss of trust, a loss of safety, a loss of control of your body. And do you know what they'll say, Veronica?
No.
Wow, that's the first time I ever heard anyone put it. That's exactly what I feel. And I some other losses, too. I said, oh, name them. One of them being that because if they were sexually abused, never feeling that that'd be okay in their normal, you know, as a normal boy or girl out there in the world with boys and girls their own age or anything like that. So there are other losses that come along with it. And once we establish this language of loss, instead of a diagnostic language, PTSD is a diagnostic word. So is trauma.
Yeah.
When I say loss of trust, loss of safety, loss of control of my body, now we're talking that that will correlate to your relationship with someone who did it. If your grandfather or father or mother abused you on a regular basis, you also have a relationship of some sort with them. So we have to go look at all the things, good, bad, and ugly, and there'll be a lot of ugly with that. Mm-hmm. And the threats, if you ever tell your mother or father, I'll kill you. That's what happens with abuse, okay? Mm-hmm. So
you mean the child will say that to the parent?
Yeah. No. The abuser will tell the child. If you tell your, you know, the grandfather who's sexually abusing the little girl,
right?
Tell your parents, I'll kill you. They threaten them either directly or indirectly. So you can't tell anybody. Can't tell anybody. Kids are scared to death.
So when that actually happens, when someone kills himself, have you worked with kids that have?
If they've actually killed themselves, I can't work with them. Sorry.
No, bad joke.
Who have attempted suicide? Absolutely.
No. If the perpetrator says, if you tell, I will kill myself.
No. The perpetrator didn't say that. The perpetrator says, if you tell, I will kill you.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's a different. Yeah. That's I didn't.
Well, I know several people had it the other way. If you tell, I will kill myself. And they did that.
I have never funny, with all the experience I've had, I have no conscious memory of ever being told that. I would have remembered that.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. But there's also another thing I want to say is a couple of us were widowed way back. I told you I was widowed at 32, and I did have a lot of trauma about it, or whatever you want to call it. But I was acting out. I was kind of volatile, and I was a whole bunch of things. And reading Kubler-Ross to save my whatever left of my mind there was. But I have another friend who had been widowed before me. And she said, keep going, because I froze up and I haven't been able to thaw out. So she became really frozen.
Paralyzed.
Yeah, to feelings. That, as far as I know, and that was, 40 years ago, she's still not feeling much. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Very common. Now, here's two things. I am not very likely to meet that kind of person.
Okay.
Why? Because they're not going to come out and ask for help. If they're frozen, they don't go to the griever and say, hey, I'm helping help. I'm frozen with my feelings. Can you help me? They usually stay where they are. But when they do venture out, if they get to me, I can help them. Because the minute they've said, I need help, then I own them. I own them in the most positive sense. Because then I say, oh, gosh, can you give me a little idea what happened? And they say, oh, my gosh, no one. I imagine you just froze up. It's been impossible for all these decades to talk to anyone. Absolutely. How brilliant of you for you to survive that way, and at the same time you've lost a bunch of your life. So let's work as fast as we can to get you back to being able to live.
Retrieve, yeah. You know, you must really love these people, because I really see how your heart, you really, not thrive on it, but you really gain a lot personally as you help these people out of all this, eh?
Oh, are you kidding? Ask me, they say, isn't it depressing working with grief every day? Are you kidding? It's the most uplifting thing in the world. Every griever I talk to, everyone who comes here, with very few exceptions, who calls me on the phone or I meet, by the time the conversation has been going on for a couple minutes, I can hear the change in the tone of their voice. At first, they're kind of like this. And then all of a sudden, their voice is like this. And all of a sudden, there's energy as they feel listened to and heard.
Wow.
And they feel hope that recovery is possible. Look where my voice is going with that.
Yeah.
And energy change. Now, when that call ends, how do you think I feel, Veronica?
Wonderful.
Like $1 trillion. It's like
you're doing something on the planet, Russell.
Absolutely. Making a difference, having a value. And then that allows me to have a normal life at home. I don't have to be special there. I mean, I go home feeling good about myself, and I go with my dogs and my granddaughter and my spouse and my stepdaughter, and I can have the kind of joy of that. So this doing of helping others isn't so that I get to be a hero or some sort of special guy. It's what allows me to be a normal guy, to balance me, to say, wow, I've done this thing that feels incredibly good. Now let me take the energy of that and spread it around and enjoy more. Because, you know, I've watched people lose balance and do only the caretaking, only the good stuff. And they lose the rest of it. And I think, Veronica, you got to have the whole package. You need all the relationships with all the different kinds of aspects of your life and not just one piece.
That's really interesting the way you put it, relationships, because it's all about how relationships we work with relationships. All of the healing you've talked about is like that, right?
Absolutely.
And I have to say goodbye. I hate to, because this is really interesting, but I might come to the Grief Institute and take your 4-day course.
I would love that.
As I work with lots of people. But I thank you, Russell Friedman. You're just a very inspiring interviewee, and I love the work you're doing here in L.A. at the Grief Institute. But it's not just in L.A., is it? You do it all over the
place. www.griefrecoverymethod.com, and on there are hundreds of articles we've written you can download and print for free, and it will guide you to, we have grief recovery specialists who we've trained in every community in America. You can find them on our specialist finder and talk to them, see if you feel comfortable. And you know, I want people to know we have 5 books: the Grief Recovery Handbook, When Children Grieve, Moving On, Moving Beyond Loss, and the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. And we have donated thousands of copies of those books to libraries all over the country. Please don't let money stop you. Get the books are out there in the library to help you. I don't care if I have your money. What I want is your heart. I'm really greedy. I want your heart back in the game of life. If I ever get money from you, no big deal. I couldn't care less. I want your heart.
What a wonderful, wonderful man. What a wonderful organization. So thank you so much, Russell Friedman. And this is Veronica Entwistle saying, now you've learned some more about real paradigm shifting into a life of heart and good relationship. And let me know what you think. VeronicaEntwistle.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening.